Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Well, coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with Malik and Jamil from the Silk Road Theater Project. They will be talking to Ann Nicholson Weber about how they started the company and what they plan on doing with it. Also, we have another audio review for you, and of course, Chicago's theater news. So sit back and relax, and get ready to talk some theater.
Hello, you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. And I'm your host this week, Ann Nicholson Weber. I'm here today with Malik Jalani, who is the executive director of the Silk Road Theater Project, and Jamil Khoury, who is the artistic director of the company. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You guys have rather unusual backgrounds for theater company runners, founders, and maybe you could each start. Maybe Jamil, you could go first and just tell us who you are, what you did before this. And
absolutely. Well, I'm the artistic director, co-founder of the company. My academic background is primarily in the social sciences, so I am not a trained theater professional or theater artist. My undergraduate work was at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service with a focus on Middle East studies. And my graduate work was a master's from the Divinity School, the University of Chicago Divinity School, so religious studies. I spent about 5 years collectively living, working, studying in the Middle East, various places, Syria, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, traveled quite a bit in that region and other parts of the world. Had an interest in theater always and a specific interest in playwriting, but really did not imagine this being the course that my life would take. And the past 10 years, I have also been working as a cross-cultural and diversity consultant, primarily with mid to high-level executives being sent overseas and foreign nationals coming to this country. So I have a definite grounding, if you will, in both international relations and international business and the discussion of culture.
Interesting. And Malik?
Well, I'm the executive director of the theater company, and I've been an IT consultant manager of IT consulting company for over 12 years. My background, educational background, is I have a bachelor's in the great books of the Western canon, so studied a lot of philosophy and languages of the Western world, classical Greek, so on. I went for my master's to the University of Chicago, Graduate School of Business, and I did that really to pacify my parents, who were really pissed off that I went and got a bachelor's that wasn't going to get me a job. And look where I ended up now.
Yeah, that lot of good that MBA right. did you, right? Well, so now the obvious question. How did the two of you start a theater company?
Sure.
Silk Road is a response to 9/11. Had there not been a 9/11 or something of that magnitude, we would not be running a theater company today. For about a year after the attacks, we talked a lot about how we could essentially respond. And I was doing public speaking and some work in my kind of other capacity as a cultural consultant, and we made a video together about Arab Americans and Muslim Americans. My father is from Syria, so I grew up very much involved with the Arab American community. Malik is from Pakistan. Came here when he was quite young. So, you know, clearly 9/11 impacted us and spoke to us in a very specific way. And we saw these huge gaps in terms of information and understanding on many sides of the divides, and we thought that theater would be a really wonderful medium for bridging a lot of that. And theater becomes a safe space for creating empathy and intersections.
Mm-hmm. And this was the clash of ignorance, if you will, is something that we noticed after 9/11. I'm Muslim American, and if you met us in person, Jamil could pass for an Irish man, but I couldn't. And so days after 9/11, I was under intense scrutiny by a lot of people, including the clients I had in the IT world. I had employees who quit their jobs.
Wow.
I had clients who barred me from visiting their data centers, and I was their consultant. I had clients who, if they did allow me in, had photos of Osama bin Laden in their server rooms with darts through his head. My own brother, who was running a gas station in Atlanta at that time, began getting graffitis on his wall, essentially telling him to go home. What happened with my brother was he was murdered. The Atlanta police, where he was murdered, determined that it was a hate crime. So looking at all these events in my life, my own personal experience, my experience with the people in my life and in my world, or the client world, the friendship world. I mean, I had really good clients who called, who would call me at home and say, "We know you weren't involved," and which I thought was really funny.
Duh.
Like, oh, thank you. For your vote of confidence. So, and it wasn't just what we observed. It was also we had intense conversations with community leaders. I mean, we went and spoke with a number of communities that we began to see a parallel with, who were either underrepresented or had misconceptions about their cultures in the American media and American cultural places, Japanese community, Chinese, Indian community. And we heard one thing coming out over and over again, which is that people don't know who we are. So because they don't know who we are, and because we're living in a society where curiosity doesn't always result in research or results in very surface-born research, like reading, a newspaper article and thinking, oh, my God, this is the God's word, and this is really what these people are. And so we thought, we have two choices. We have the choice to do nothing and say, it's a tough world, right? And carry on with our, at that time, very successful life. We could do something. And we chose to do something. And a lot of that has to do with our immigrant backgrounds and natures. I mean, Jamil is second generation. And I'm first generation. I was born in Pakistan. But we both have that ethic of you make room for yourself, mm-hmm. And as an immigrant, you come in being very grateful for what you have, but then you also stand up for yourself when the room is not being made for you.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an opportunity, which was really the first time that I thought, what can I do to make room for myself and other people like me? So it really started as a personal response, and then it expanded into this response that we're calling Silk Road Theater Project and representing the Asian, Middle Eastern, and Mediterranean worlds. So the scope became bigger than what the initial motivation was, if you will.
I feel like you skipped a step, though, because we've got a business consultant and an IT guy having a personal response to 2001, and then suddenly we have a theater company. And I want to know more about how you ended up here as the form for your response.
Well, we always appreciated theater, and I have done some playwriting, and that was something that I started during graduate school as a diversion from the craziness that is graduate school at the University of Chicago. So I would just start writing scenes and putting them together, this sort of thing. So there was an attachment on some level. We went into this with zero experience in terms of running a theater company, just what I would call some good business instincts and a good sense of a good organizational.
And just the basic product and marketing knowledge that if you package something well and you sell it, there's a market for it usually. So, you know, we're good at packaging things, and we package displays well, and we market them well. And we find that there are the communities who are being represented on stage who want to see themselves, and they pay to see themselves. And then there are the regular theater goers who are frankly tired of seeing the same thing over and over again at many other stages, and this is a great diversion for them.
And, you know, we could bring artists to the table. We could, quote-unquote, outsource the art, if you will, and although I think that isn't a fully accurate sort of representation of what's going on, but, you know, build a community of directors, designers, actors. Of course, we're a playwright-focused theater, so the main emphasis is on the playwrights. So, you know, there was never a deficiency in that respect, because that's a question that has somehow come up.
Well, and most young companies, you know, you call the guy you went to graduate school with and someone you were in a play with, you know, 2 years ago, and that's how you create your artistic network. So how did you guys go about it?
Well, our first production was the play that Jamil wrote.
Yes.
Which set the whole company in motion. The play was Precious Stones, which went on to win prize for Best New Play 2003 and went on to tour 10 or 11 states.
10 or 11. It was 16 colleges 16 and universities.
And once we did that, we started really that is when we started creating the network of people from whom we can pull scripts.
So how did you, for instance, find a director for Precious Stones? Who did you?
Well, you know, I actually a director contacted me. And he at the time was living in L.A. He's now in Portland. He's moving back to L.A. I was on a listserv of Arab Americans in theater, and it was a listserv that I had just joined maybe a few weeks before. Mm-hmm. And I had posted something about this play that I was working on, and he contacted me and said, could you send me a copy? And I did, and this conversation started, and he said, you know, I would love to direct this if you're ever planning on producing it. He wasn't a Chicago director, and we were able to create a situation where he kind of had a place to stay in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I think through like an ex-girlfriend or something like that, and so he could be here, you know, to cast it and for us to mount the production.
But the interesting thing is, you can tap into the theater community if you want to do theater. I mean, it's really a matter of just asking one person who knows 20 other people they acted or worked with, and it really was that type of network that we connected with. We contacted the League of Chicago Theaters, the Cultural Center. We kind of knew what the hotbeds were of people who bring resources to the table. Mm-hmm. So definitely we knew that we can, you know, go here to find a resource. And then it was a lot of blind faith. And when you do something for the first time, you don't know if you're doing it right or wrong. And that's actually good, because if you're not doing it right, it doesn't offend you, because you don't know. You don't know if you're getting screwed. You know, you don't know if you're overpaying. You don't know if you're overspending or under. But the basics that I did know were, promote, because that's the background I come from.
Right.
And we did a lot of that. And that first year we generated feature stories and features and TVs and radios and so on and so forth, because people were attracted to this concept of telling global stories. I mean, at the end of the day, we're a global city. And what's really lacking, I feel, are authentic first voice stories from these cultures, and many of whom make their home in Chicago. So it was really that concept that I was selling. And it wasn't until we did the first play and we kind of looked back and kind of assessed what went right and what went wrong. And we took off maybe more than half a year to file a proposal for doing our next play. And by that time, we had tapped into a pool of playwrights. You know, a lot of it was internet-driven. Mm. It was all about you can post something here, and people will email you back and forth. And I don't think we could have done what we did 10 years ago when internet was less prevalent.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it was really 10 years ago from 5 years back, you know. So because internet wasn't as prevalent. But, you know, 5 years ago, almost everyone, especially in the theater and the arts world, were using the internet as a medium to communicate and share resources and point people in the right direction. And that worked to our advantage.
And I think the theater community here, and particularly institutions like the Chicago Cultural Center, have been incredibly generous and forthcoming and, you know, just helpful in this process. Our first two productions were in Department of Cultural Affairs venues, the Studio Theater of the Cultural Center, and then the now non-existing Loop Theater that was at State and Randolph. And that gave us a lot of confidence. You know, we mounted two shows, both did really well, and artistically and critically and in terms of audience. And you know, it gave us sort of a basis to start building infrastructure. We have since moved to a company model, which was not the case initially, where it really was a pas-en-pas, you know, two-man operation. And today we have about 18 company members, resident designers. We have an associate artistic director who's also a resident director, PR, a operations and production manager, so forth. So it's much more fused like that. It is not, however, an actor ensemble, which is the much more the typical Chicago model. And an actor ensemble would not serve this company because of the ethnic variants of the shows we do, you know, an Arab play, a Chinese play, an Indian play, so forth. And we do not blind color cast. You know, if we're doing an East Asian piece, we're doing a Chinese play, they're not all going to be Chinese, but they're going to be all East Asian. Mm-hmm. So that becomes very important to us. There are, however, actors that we have good relationships with and would work with over and over. But I think this sort of company model is something that's serving us well.
Do you feel like you've developed an aesthetic identity?
You know, I think that there's a thematic identity that initially evolved, and that is a sort of diasporic voice. So it's essentially the hybrid existence of being Arab American or Japanese American or Indian American. You know, the
feet in two camps.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. You know, and this is why the authorial voice is so important to us. Why we decided to be a playwright-focused theater from the beginning is that we want to work with a playwright who is from the community he or she is writing about. And whatever that relationship may be, a good one, a bad one, a complex one is usually the case. They're informed by that. They're informed by family, by tradition, by background, by, you know, immigration status, whatever the case may be. And I think that gives a very unique sort of spin.
Current. It makes it current. And I think it's because of who we are and why we started this. I mean, we didn't, you know, on the one hand, we didn't start it to see ourselves on stage because we don't act, we don't direct. On the other hand, we did, because the stories that are diasporic, we're diasporic people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I live this challenge on a day-to-day basis, every day having to explain who I am and how do I reconcile all the different parts of me that make me up with my traditional heritage and the new place that I call home. And I find that that's a very interesting lens that creates some fantastic drama. So I think that kind of drives the mission. So that's the aesthetic, if you will. Yeah.
And really an aesthetic, I would say, has emerged in the last few productions where mm-hmm. we can start seeing some threads and we can start seeing certain a certain continuity. You know, what's mm-hmm. what's linking the plays? What's
can you
linking
characterize
the stories?
That at all?
I think that inner struggle, you know, is between being here and there. I think the desire to fuse, to meld two worlds, that will oftentimes come through. I mean, I think of our play Tea, for example, mm-hmm. you know, which were Japanese war brides in Kansas, and this set that essentially combined a rural Kansan environment and a Japanese one. Mm-hmm. And to me, that becomes a very representative aesthetic.
And even plays that aren't diasporic, like Caravaggio, our last production about the Italian painter, it's a similar struggle, which is abandoning the tradition and embracing a new idea. Mm-hmm.
Which is also very much the theme of your present play, Golden exactly. Child. Tell me about Golden Child.
You know, I had wanted to... David Henry Hwang is an iconic figure in Asian America, certainly in Asian American theater, in the American theater. I always thought that he would be out of reach somehow. You know, there's kind of this great... There's this pool of Silk Road writers, and then there's David Henry Hwang.
Is he the only one in that echelon from your point of view?
Well,
you seem out of reach.
He's the only Tony Award winner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's been able to... You know, sort of cross all these different boundaries, and he can work for Disney. He can do operas. He, you know, this type of so he's achieved a level of success which has not been typical of the let's say the Asian American theater community. So he's really held in high esteem, and I didn't think he would be attainable. You know, that we could somehow get to him. And we read Golden Child and just fell in love with the play. And it is such a Silk Road play on so many levels. And I contacted an artistic director from another theater company that's more specifically devoted to East Asian work in L.A. And he sent me David's email address. I emailed David. And he immediately emailed me back, and he sent me his phone number, and we had a phone conversation. I was really, like, nervous, and I he was so personable and down-to-earth.
Not snooty.
Not at all. And you know, throughout, he's like, yes, absolutely, I've heard of you guys. I'm really excited about your mission. You know, let's work together. And, you know, so that in and of itself has just been so special to be working with someone who also works with Elton John and Phil Collins and Prince and David Bowie and, you know, who's a Broadway figure. And yet, you know, would email me from a small town in China. And so I have loved that, and I've really appreciated that, and his level of enthusiasm for the company and the fact that he's made reference to being a part of the company has been really gratifying for us.
He came and joined you during the rehearsal period, right?
Yes, he was here for a total of 6 days, the last week of rehearsals and first preview, and then he came back for the opening and has, you know, he was incredibly supportive of the director, of the cast, of the design team. I mean, certainly gave his input and some notes, which were very helpful.
And the company, I mean, he went on, you know, interviews, and he did all these talk sessions with the community at large and Cultural Center, Columbia College, and he essentially said, "What can I do to help you be more successful in your endeavors?" And that really, you know, is unusual.
It impressed us a great,
yeah, and, kind and of that, generosity.
And that he would say, you know, everyone's saying to me, "Oh, it's so nice that you're helping those guys out. This is so great." He's like, "Wait a minute, they're producing my play.
Yeah,
this there's some self interest here."
Right, right. Again, sort of not snooty. He was taking this as seriously as any production. There are a number of ways we could go here. One is to talk very quickly about your space, which is quite extraordinary, I think.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the story?
Sure. We have our permanent theater in downtown Loop Theater District at the historic Chicago Temple Building. When we were doing Jamil's first play, Precious Stones, one of the many hats that I wore was to sell tickets to the play. And I was contacting all pastors and mosque leaders and synagogue leaders to buy group tickets to this play, which I thought would be really interesting to them. And I ended up calling on Dr. Philip Blackwell, who's the senior pastor at the First United Methodist Church, who owns the building that we're in. And after many back and forth voicemails to each other, we ended up setting up a meeting, and I took Jamil with me, and we did our pitch about why we believe that Silk Road is an important company and why we think he should buy, maybe 20 tickets to the play. And he said, "Well, I don't know about the tickets, but what would you think about becoming a theater in residence in our building?"
Wow.
And so it was really, the idea was driven by Phil, who really came up with the original concept of, you know, "Hey, we really believe in your mission." And he said, you know, that some of the perils he saw was they tell stories and we tell stories. And we're both, you know, pulling at hearts and souls in our own ways. So once we became the theater in residence, we noticed this underutilized basement. And
When you were a theater in residence before this space was developed, where were you?
Well, we really had sort of what I call the quasi-itinerant status, or in that we could use spaces in the building, including what was then sort of a raw basement space. And we would use it for auditions and staged readings and workshops and, you know, rehearsal space. But this was not viewed as a producing and a performing space. Mm-hmm. So it was really a wonderful, just sort of by chance, the church had wanted to renovate this space for some time. And so when they were ready to do that, they came to us and said, what would your needs be? You know, what would we need to do to accommodate a theater company within our sort of mixed-use, shared space vision? And that was quite extraordinary.
It was.
Because, you know, I mean, we were in the conversation from the very beginning. And once again, it was one of these situations where it's like, well, we don't really know because we've never built a theater before. And so we started asking around and people were giving us kind of checklists and so forth. And we found the architects and ultimately, you know, the building owners, the church, to be very cooperative. And, you know, there was a strong desire to work with us. I just want to backtrack a little about what makes this relationship all the more interesting is that First United Methodist Church at the Chicago Temple, this congregation is the oldest church in the city. Mm-hmm. It predates the incorporation of Chicago by 6 years. It goes to 1831. But I oftentimes will refer to them as old Americans, you know, people with deep roots in this country. And a lot of the parishioners here will go back to the 1600s or the 1700s. And we're very new Americans. And I find that sort of connection to be a very exciting one. And, you know, they're very secure in who they are. And obviously, or they, you know, probably wouldn't host a theater like ours. And it's about wanting to hear the stories of new Americans and wanting to engage on that level. So I think it's just it's a unique relationship. And so there are plenty of theaters that have been in church basements or are in church. That's not a new idea, but this is a real institutional and organizational relationship.
And you look at the investment in this space. You know, it's a $1.6 million build out, 1.5 of which was provided by the church.
There must be a lot of people in Chicago who are really jealous of you guys. Well, there's another thing I'd like to talk to you about, which is that besides being business partners, you guys are life partners,
yes,
which I think adds some interesting, I would imagine, richness and perhaps complexity to what you do. For instance, my brother and sister-in-law were in business together and found it very difficult and no mm-hmm. longer are. How has it been for you?
Well, when we agree, it's wonderful. We disagree, it's really hellish.
You know, I think it's been it's introduced an element of strain at times. I mean, certainly the pressure of creating an organization like this is huge. I mean,
but, you know, we could not create it if we weren't both in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think I could let Jamil work 20 hours a day if he was doing this with someone else.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And I know that for a fact because before we started the theater, how demanding we were on each other's time for personal time and fun time, which, of course, has all gone out the window now.
Well, except your whole life is personal fun time in one way.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. That's a good way to look at it.
You know, I think the fact that we have a division of labor. I mean, it's not a traditional executive director, artistic director paradigm in that we're both fundamentally producers and, mm-hmm. you know, but we just kind of divide the work. But, you know, we can share ideas at 3 a.m. And I mean, the problem is how to bring the other company members into this very intimate conversation.
Totally. Right. Certain insularity there that could be daunting for other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's something we...
A lot of our projects are conceptualized and fleshed out on our nightly walk. I mean, you know, we'll walk for a couple hours a night and we talk through the issues of the day and our visions and what we read that day, you know, how it inspired us. So we go to bed agreeing on a lot of things and we wake up the next day and realize that the rest of the company has no idea what's going
on. All this happened, right. So how do you address that issue?
We do a lot of conversations. I mean, a lot of emailing,
right.
A lot of meetings, get-togethers. And we've carved out respect for everyone, you know, where we can make unilateral decisions. We choose not to, you know, and we choose to have a dialogue. There is a lot of push and pull with the company members, you know, who don't always agree with our, you know, visual aesthetic for the logos, if you will, for our shows, or who, you know, don't agree with the ticket pricing or whatever. But we all, at the end of the day, we all agree that each one brings a strength in a certain area.
I mean, my impression is that what both of you are connectors, that that's really the mission of the company and perhaps your strengths as human beings. And I could imagine that that becomes the way that you deal with this issue. I think it's pretty amazing what you have done in these 4 years and really wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another elite episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of March 19th, 2007. Tom Amendes will be coming back to Chicago to star in the Victory Gardens' Cynical Weathers. You may remember this veteran of Chicago's off-loop stages when he appeared as Dr. Harold Abbott on the hit series Everwood, or you may remember him from TV's The Untouchables. Well, now he is coming back home to Chicago to star in the new Victory Gardens theater play, Cynical Weathers. It's a new political drama by Douglas Post, and in it, Tom Amendes will be originating the role of Congressman Dixon McDaniels, a Texas Republican congressman caught between his liberal wife and his conservative chief of staff. The show is going to be directed by artistic director of the Victory Gardens, Dennis Zajcik, and also stars Kat McDaniels, Manny Hernandez, and Lee Gelman. Cynical Weathers opens on April 6th at the Victory Gardens new Biograph Theater. For more information, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Remy Bumpo Theater Company has announced their 2007-2008 season, and here it is. The season starts off with Fiction, directed by Nick Sandys, who we interviewed a couple of months ago. Fiction opens on September 27th and runs through November. And following that will be a classic, The Philadelphia Story by Philip Barry. This show will be directed by Sean Douglas and opens on November 15th. Afterwards will be Bronte, directed by James Bonin. The show by Polly Teal opens on March 20th and is, of course, about the infamous literary sisters. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast as the shows get closer and as we get more information for you. The Tribune Stage Ticker is reporting that Congo Square Theater Company is definitely going to be the resident theater company for the Chicago Center for the Performing Arts all year long. The company is best known for working out of the Duncan YMCA in the Chicago Loop, and just recently closed August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone to wonderful reviews. Congratulations, Congo Square Theater Company. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, that you too can make the news, and we're more than happy to spread it. If you have something that you feel is definitely Chicago theater news worthy, then send it on to us. The email address is very easy. It's simply news@hawktheaterinchicago.com. We are eager to see what you think is news. And who knows? What you send us may just end up on the Theater News Podcast. Well, thank you very much for listening to this elite episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from Sonnet 94, line 14. Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to this podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ear. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it. You're listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago Review Podcast, Mrs. Warren's Profession, by George Bernard Shaw. Directed by David Darlow and produced by Remy Bumbo Think Theater at Victory Gardens Greenhouse Theater. Review by Tom Williams. Remy Bumbo Think Theater, a Chicago treasure of excellent theater, has mounted a flawless production of George Bernard Shaw's social commentary on women's role in society and the hypocrisy of Victorian England. The play Mrs. Warren's Profession, written in 1893, was censored for 8 years before being produced in 1902. It illuminates the struggle women face to obtain independence and a decent standard of living versus the choice of morally acceptable roads, such as marriage, to obtain that fulfillment. Shaw has smart and aggressive women opposite the typical English men, from the artistic soul Praed, played by Donald Brearley, to the opportunistic, money-hungry Frank, played by Matt Schwader, to the ruthless, amoral capitalist Sir George, played by Kevin Goodall, and the hypocritical vicar Reverend Samuel, played by Joe Van Slyke. Shaw is tough on the men as they smugly condescend and try to marginalize their women. Shaw counters that with an intelligent, young, determined woman, Vivi Warren, played by Susan Shunk, who is set on becoming an actuary, utilizing her Cambridge degree in mathematics. Vivi holds off advances from Frank, Sir George, as she has a rare encounter with her mother, who lives on the continent. Kitty Warren reveals the source of her wealth to Vivi, as she admits to being part of the oldest profession. Vivi also wants to know who her father is, and press Kitty for that information. The women are complete characters, filled with both feminine charm and fierce ambition. Shaw throws barbs at capitalism, and he makes the case that prostitution did more for women than menial labor at a factory, as women could gain immense wealth in pleasing men, and that prostitution is, indeed, an industry similar to any capitalist venture. Shaw smartly deals with the dilemma faced by evolving feminists like Vivi, as they struggle to make their own wealth independent of men and estranged mothers. Mrs. Warren's Profession features wonderful performances from the A-list equity players, led by Annabelle Armour's striking Kitty. Armour blends Kitty's nouveau refinement to old crude Cockney slang. Susan Shunk's Vivi is filled with deep-seated strength, while Matt Schwader's charm and warmth wins us. Veteran actors Kevin Goodall, David Brearley, and Joe Van Slyke render terrific work as Shaw's comedy still carries enough bite to be relevant today. With authentic British accents and dressed in period-perfect costumes, Mrs. Warren's Profession moves us into the stuffy world of late Victorian England. We enjoy each minute from one of the great wordsmiths. Kudos to Remy Bumpo for their continued outstanding productions. I give this a highly recommended Mrs. Warren's Profession, by George Bernard Shaw, directed by David Darlow, and produced by Remy Bumpo Think Theater at Victory Gardens Greenhouse Theater, located at 2257 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago, Illinois, now through April 22nd. For tickets and more information, call 773-871-3000. Call 773-871-3000. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Malik and Jamil from the Silk Road Theater Project for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.